begin a withdrawal. Enough is enough, I said. Still, Sharon wouldn't budge. By the time Crown Prince Abdullah arrived at our ranch, his peace plan had been shelved. He was angered by the violence, furious with Sharon, and, I soon learned, frustrated with me. The Crown Prince is a gentle, modest, almost shy man. He speaks softly, doesn't drink alcohol, and prays 5 times a day. In 8 years, I never saw him without his traditional robes. After a brief discussion, Abdullah asked for time alone with his foreign minister and ambassador. A few minutes later, State Department interpreter Gamal Halal came to me with a stricken look on his face. "Mr. President," he said, "I think the Saudis are getting ready to leave." I was surprised. I thought the meeting had been going fine. But Gamal explained that the Saudis had expected me to persuade Sharon to withdraw from Ramallah before the Crown Prince arrived. Now they were insisting that I call the Israeli Prime Minister on the spot. I wasn't going to conduct diplomacy that way. I sent Colin into the living room to see what was going on. He confirmed that our guests were headed for the door. America's pivotal relationship with Saudi Arabia was about to be seriously ruptured. I walked into the living room with Gamal and asked for a moment alone with the Crown Prince. I had read 2 interesting things about him in a background briefing. One was that he was a devout religious believer. The other was that he loved his farm. "Your Royal Highness," I said, "I would like to discuss religion with you." I talked about my belief in Christianity and the role religion played in my life. I hoped he would reciprocate by talking about his faith. He wasn't in a sharing mood. In a last gasp effort, I said, "Before you leave, may I show you my ranch?" He nodded. A few minutes later, the Crown Prince, flowing robes and all, was climbing into a Ford F-250 pickup. Then he, Gamal, and I took off for a tour of the property. I pointed out the different kinds of hardwood trees, the native prairie grasses that Laura had planted, and the grazing cattle. The Crown Prince sat silently. I wasn't making much headway. Then we reached a remote part of the property. A lone hen turkey was standing in the road. I stopped the truck. The bird stayed put. "What is that?" the Crown Prince asked. I told him it was a turkey. "Benjamin Franklin loved the turkey so much he wanted it to be America's national bird," I said. Suddenly I felt the Crown Prince's hand grab my arm. "My brother," he said, "it is a sign from Allah. This is a good omen." I've never fully understood the significance of the bird, but I felt the tension begin to melt. When we got back to the house, our aides were surprised to hear us say we were ready for lunch. The next day, I got a call from Mother and Dad. The Crown Prince had stopped in Houston to visit them. Mother said he had tears in his eyes as he recounted his time in Crawford and talked about what we could achieve together. For the rest of my presidency, my relationship with the Crown Prince, soon to be king, was extremely close. I had never seen a hen turkey on that part of the property before, and I haven't seen one since. As I thought more about the turmoil in the Middle East, I concluded that the fundamental problem was the lack of freedom in the Palestinian territories. With no state, Palestinians lacked their rightful place in the world. With no voice in their future, Palestinians were ripe for recruiting by extremists. And with no legitimately elected Palestinian leader committed to fighting terror, the Israelis had no reliable partner for peace. I believed the solution was a democratic Palestinian state, led by elected officials who would answer to their people, reject terror, and pursue peace with Israel. As violence in the Holy Land escalated in the spring of 2002, I decided we needed a game changer. I planned to outline my commitment to a Palestinian democracy with a major speech in the Rose Garden. I would be the first president to publicly call for a Palestinian state as a matter of policy. I hoped setting forward a bold vision would help both sides make the hard choices necessary for peace. The idea sparked controversy, starting in my administration. While Condi and Steve Hadley supported it, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, and Colin Powell all told me I shouldn't give the speech. Dick and Don were concerned that supporting a Palestinian state in the midst of an intifada would look like rewarding terrorism. Colin worried that calling for new Palestinian leadership would embarrass Arafat and reduce the chance for a negotiated settlement. I understood the risks, but I was convinced that a democratic Palestinian state and a new Palestinian leadership were the only way to forge a lasting peace. My vision is two states living side by side in peace and security, I said in the Rose Garden on June 24, 2002. There is simply no way to achieve that peace until all parties fight terror. I call on the Palestinian people to elect new leaders, leaders not compromised by terror. I call upon them to build a practicing democracy based on tolerance and liberty. If the Palestinian people actively pursue these goals, America and the world will actively support their efforts. My support for a Palestinian state was overwhelmed by my call for new leadership. Bush demands Arafat's ouster, one headline read. Shortly after the speech, Mother called. How's the first Jewish president doing? She asked. I had a funny feeling she disagreed with my policy. That meant Dad probably did as well. I wasn't surprised. While I considered Arafat a failed leader, many in the foreign policy world accepted the view that Arafat represented the best hope for peace. I laughed off Mother's wisecrack, but I took her message to heart. I was in for some serious opposition. The day after the speech, I flew to Kananaskis, Canada, for the annual G8 meeting. The summit was supposed to focus on foreign aid, but my speech on the Middle East was on everyone's mind. I ran into Tony Blair in the gym the morning before the first meeting. You've really kicked up quite a storm, George, he said with a smile. Others were less accepting. Jacques Chirac, European Commission President Romano Prodi, and Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien clearly disapproved. By rejecting Arafat, the heralded Nobel Peace Prize winner, I had upended their worldview. I told them I was convinced Arafat would never prove a reliable partner for peace. Colin took the lead in hammering out a detailed plan to move from my speech to a Palestinian state. Called the roadmap, it included three phases. First, Palestinians would stop terrorist attacks, fight corruption, reform their political system, and hold democratic elections. In return, Israel would withdraw from unauthorized settlements. In the second phase, the two sides would begin direct negotiations, leading to the creation of a provisional Palestinian state. In the third phase, the Palestinians and Israelis would resolve the most complicated issues, including the status of Jerusalem, the rights of Palestinian refugees, and permanent borders. Arab nations would support the negotiations and establish normal relations with Israel. With Tony Blair's encouragement, I decided to announce the roadmap in the spring of 2003, shortly after we removed Saddam Hussein from Iraq. Both the Israelis and Palestinians supported the plan. In early June, I met with Arab leaders in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, to stress my commitment to peace and urge them to stay engaged in the process. Then I traveled to Aqaba, Jordan, for a session with Palestinian and Israeli representatives. Given all the recent bloodshed, I expected a tense session. To my surprise, the mood was friendly and relaxed. It was clear many leaders knew one another from previous peace efforts. But I knew there was a lot of history to overcome. Mohammed Dahlan, the Palestinian security chief, liked to remind people where he had learned to speak fluent Hebrew, in the Israeli jails. The Palestinians had taken an important step by naming a prime minister to represent them at the summit, Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas was a friendly man who seemed to genuinely want peace. He was a little unsure of himself, partly because he hadn't been elected and partly because he was trying to emerge from Arafat's shadow. He said he was willing to confront the terrorists, but before he could turn his words into action, he needed money and reliable security forces. After the formal meetings, I invited Sharon and Abbas to take a walk on the lawn. Under the palm trees, I told them we had a historic opportunity for peace. Ariel Sharon made clear, at Aqaba, and later in his landmark Herzliya speech, that he had abandoned the Greater Israel policy, an enormous breakthrough. It is in Israel's interest not to govern the Palestinians, but for the Palestinians to govern themselves in their own state, he said at Aqaba. Abbas declared, the armed intifada must end, and we must use and resort to peaceful means in our quest to end the occupation and the suffering of Palestinians and Israelis. We had a long way to go, but it was a hopeful moment in the Middle East. In April 2004, Ariel Sharon came to Washington to brief me on a historic decision. He planned to withdraw from Israel's settlements in Gaza and parts of the northern West Bank. As a father of the settlement movement, it would be agonizing for him to tell Israeli families they had to leave their homes. But his bold move achieved two important goals. It extricated Israel from the costly occupation of Gaza, and by returning territory to Palestinian control, it served as a down payment on a future state. I was hopeful that Abbas would match Sharon's tough decision with a positive step. But in September 2003, Prime Minister Abbas resigned after Arafat undermined him at every turn. Just over a year later, Arafat died. In January 2005, Palestinian voters went to the polls for the first time in a decade. Abbas campaigned on a platform to halt violence and resume progress toward a Palestinian state. He was elected in a landslide. He set to work developing the institutions of a democratic state and called for legislative elections. Abbas's party, Fatah, was still tainted with the corruption of the Arafat era. The main alternative was Hamas, a terrorist organization that also had a well-organized political apparatus. The prospect of a Hamas victory understandably unnerved the Israelis. I supported the elections. America could not be in the position of endorsing elections only when we liked the projected outcome. I knew the election would be just one step on the journey to democracy. Whoever won would inherit the responsibilities of governing, building roads and schools, enforcing the rule of law, and developing the institutions of a civil society. If they performed well, they would be reelected. If not, the people would have a chance to change their minds. Whatever the outcome, free and fair elections reveal the truth. On January 25, 2006, the truth was that Palestinians were tired of Fatah's corruption. Hamas won 74 of 132 seats. Some interpreted the results as a setback for peace. I wasn't so sure. Hamas had run on a platform of clean government and efficient public services, not war with Israel. Hamas also benefited from Fatah's poorly run campaign. Fatah often ran multiple candidates for the same seat, which split the party vote. The election made clear that Fatah had to modernize its party. It also forced the decision within Hamas. Would it fulfill its promise to govern as a legitimate party, or would it revert to violence? In March 2006, voters went to the polls for another election. This one was in Israel. 2 months earlier, Ariel Sharon had suffered a debilitating stroke. I've always wondered what might have been possible if Ariel had continued to serve. He had established his credibility on security. He had the trust of the Israeli people. And I believe he could have been part of a historic peace. The vote for a new prime minister would be a test of Israeli commitment to the two-state solution. Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert campaigned hard in support of it. I had met Ehud on my 1998 trip to Israel when he was mayor of Jerusalem. He was easygoing and confident, with a gregarious manner and a ready laugh. The only solution now is two states, one Jewish, one Palestinian, he said during the campaign. At one point, he suggested he would create a Palestinian state unilaterally if necessary. Israeli voters rewarded him at the polls. Olmert and Abbas, who retained the presidency despite Hamas's victory in the legislative elections, quickly developed a working relationship. They found agreement on issues such as security checkpoints and the release of some prisoners. Then, in June 2007, the militant wing of Hamas intervened. In a familiar pattern in the ideological struggle, the extremists responded to the advance of freedom with violence. Hamas terrorists, backed by Iran and Syria, mounted a coup and seized control of Gaza. Fighters in black masks ransacked Fatah headquarters, threw party leaders off rooftops, and targeted moderate members of Hamas's political wing. President Abbas responded by expelling Hamas from his cabinet and consolidating his authority on the West Bank. "It's basically a coup d'etat against democracy itself," Abbas told me on the phone. "Syria and Iran are trying to set the Middle East ablaze." We redirected our economic and security assistance to Abbas's government in the West Bank and supported an Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. While we sent humanitarian aid to prevent starvation, the people of Gaza would see a vivid contrast between their living conditions under Hamas and those under the democratic leader, Abbas. Over time, I was confident they would demand change. Condi and I talked about a way to restart momentum for a democratic Palestinian state. She suggested an international conference to lay the groundwork for negotiations between Abbas's government and the Israelis. At first, I was skeptical. The aftermath of a terrorist coup didn't seem the most opportune time for a peace summit. But I came to like the idea. If wavering Palestinians could see that a state was a realistic possibility, they would have an incentive to reject violence and support reform. We scheduled the conference for November 2007 at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. Condi and I persuaded 15 Arab nations to send delegations, including Saudi Arabia. Investing Arab partners in the process early would boost Palestinians' confidence and make it harder for them to later reject a peace deal, as Arafat had at Camp David. The key test of the conference was whether Abbas and Olmert could agree on a joint statement pledging to open negotiations. When we boarded the helicopter for the flight to Annapolis, I asked Condi for the statement. She said they had made a lot of progress, but hadn't finished. "You're going to have to deliver this one yourself," she said. I pulled Abbas and Olmert aside individually. I told them the summit would be viewed as a failure and embolden the extremists if we couldn't agree on a statement. They instructed their negotiators to work with Condi. A few minutes before we were due in front of the cameras, she brought me the document. There was no time to enlarge the font, so I pulled out my reading glasses and read from the page. "We agree to immediately launch good faith bilateral negotiations in order to conclude a peace treaty, and shall make every effort to conclude an agreement before the end of 2008. The room broke into applause. Abbas and Olmert delivered speeches of their own. "Freedom is the single word that stands for the future of the Palestinians," President Abbas said. "I believe that there is no path other than peace. I believe it is time. We are ready," Prime Minister Olmert said. It was a historic moment to see the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia listen respectfully to the Prime Minister of Israel and applaud his words. The Annapolis conference was hailed as a surprise success. The cynicism about the Annapolis talks shouldn't overshadow the hope that came out of the effort, the Los Angeles Times wrote. Shortly after Annapolis, the two sides opened negotiations on a peace agreement, with Ahmed Qwery representing the Palestinians and Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni representing the Israelis. Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, an economist with a Ph.D. from the University of Texas, began carrying out long-needed reforms in the Palestinian economy and security forces. "We sent financial assistance and deployed a high-ranking general to help train the Palestinian security forces." The day he left Downing Street, Tony Blair accepted a post as special envoy to help the Palestinians build the institutions of a democratic state. It wasn't glamorous work, but it was necessary. If I win the Nobel Peace Prize, Tony joked, you will know I have failed. The negotiations resolved some important issues, but it was clear that striking an agreement would require more involvement from the leaders. With my approval, Condi quietly oversaw a separate channel of talks directly between Abbas and Olmert. The dialogue culminated in a secret proposal from Olmert to Abbas. His offer would have returned the vast majority of the territory in the West Bank and Gaza to the Palestinians, accepted the construction of a tunnel connecting the two Palestinian territories, allowed a limited number of Palestinian refugees to return to Israel, established Jerusalem as a joint capital of both Israel and Palestine, and entrusted control of the holy sites to a panel of non-political elders. We devised a process to turn the private offer into a public agreement. Olmert would travel to Washington and deposit his proposal with me. Abbas would announce that the plan was in line with Palestinian interests. I would call the leaders together to finalize the deal. The development represented a realistic hope for peace, but once again, an outside event intervened. Olmert had been under investigation for his financial dealings when he was mayor of Jerusalem. By late summer, his political opponents had enough ammunition to bring him down. He was forced to announce his resignation in September. Abbas didn't want to make an agreement with the prime minister on his way out of office. The talks broke off in the final weeks of my administration, after Israeli forces launched an offensive in Gaza in response to Hamas rocket attacks. While I was disappointed that the Israelis and Palestinians could not finalize an agreement, I was pleased with the progress we had made. 8 years earlier, I had taken office during a raging intifada, with Yasser Arafat running the Palestinian Authority, Israeli leaders committed to a greater Israel policy, and Arab nations complaining from the sidelines. By the time I left, the Palestinians had a president and prime minister who rejected terrorism. The Israelis had withdrawn from some settlements and supported a two-state solution, and Arab nations were playing an active role in the peace process. The struggle in the Holy Land is no longer Palestinian versus Israeli, or Muslim versus Jew. It is between those who seek peace and extremists who promote terror. And there is consensus that democracy is the foundation on which to build a just and lasting peace. Realizing that vision will require courageous leadership from both sides, and from the United States. Jacques Chirac and I didn't agree on much. The French president opposed removing Saddam Hussein. He called Yasser Arafat a man of courage. At one meeting, he told me, Ukraine is part of Russia. So it came as quite a surprise when Jacques and I found an area of agreement at our meeting in Paris in early June 2004. Chirac brought up democracy in the Middle East, and I braced myself for another lecture. But he continued, in this region, there are just two democracies. One is strong, Israel. The other is fragile, Lebanon. I didn't mention that he'd left out a new democracy, Iraq. He described Lebanon's suffering under the occupation of Syria, which had tens of thousands of troops in the country, siphoned money from the economy, and strangled attempts to expand democracy. He suggested that we work together to stop Syria from dominating Lebanon. I immediately agreed. We decided to look for an opportunity to introduce a UN resolution. In August 2004, Lebanese President Amir Lahoud, a Syrian puppet, gave us our opening. He announced he would extend his term in office, a violation of the Lebanese constitution. Chirac and I co-sponsored UN Resolution 1559, which protested Lahoud's decision and demanded that Syria withdraw its forces. It passed on September 2, 2004. For 6 months, Syria responded with defiance. Then on February 14, 2005, a huge car bomb in Beirut destroyed the motorcade of Rafik Hariri, Lebanon's pro-independence former prime minister. All the evidence pointed to a Syrian plot. We recalled our ambassador from Damascus and supported a UN investigation. A week after Hariri's murder, Chirac and I had dinner in Brussels. we issued a joint statement calling the car bombing a terrorist act and reiterated our support for a sovereign, independent, and democratic Lebanon. Chirac and I rallied Arab nations to pressure Syrian President Bashar Assad to comply with the UN resolution. On the one-month anniversary of Hariri's murder, nearly a million Lebanese people, a quarter of the nation's population, turned out at Mader's Square in Beirut to protest Syria's occupation. People began to speak of a cedar revolution, named for the tree in the middle of Lebanon's flag. The Syrians got the message. Under the combined pressure of the international community and the Lebanese people, Syrian occupation troops began to withdraw in late March. By the end of April, they were gone. "People used to be afraid to say anything here," one Lebanese citizen told a reporter. "People seem to be opening up more today and feeling more comfortable to speak their mind." That spring, the anti-Syrian March 14th movement won a majority of seats in the parliament. Fouad Sinoura, a close advisor to the slain Hariri, was named prime minister. The cedar revolution marked one of the most important successes of the freedom agenda. It took place in a multi-religious country with a Muslim majority. It happened with strong diplomatic pressure from the free world and with no American military involvement. The people of Lebanon achieved their independence for the simplest of reasons. They wanted to be free. The triumph of democracy in Lebanon came 2 months after the free elections in Iraq and the election of President Abbas in the Palestinian territories. Never before had three Arab societies made so much progress toward democracy. Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine had the potential to serve as the foundation of a free and peaceful region. It's strange for me to say it, but this process of change has started because of the American invasion of Iraq, Lebanese political leader Walid Jumblatt said. "I was cynical about Iraq, but when I saw the Iraqi people voting 3 weeks ago, 8 million of them, it was the start of a new Arab world. The Syrian people, the Egyptian people, all say that something is changing. The Berlin Wall has fallen. We can see it." He wasn't the only one who observed the trend or recognized its consequences. The rising tide of democracy in the Middle East in 2005 jolted the extremists. In 2006, they fought back. On July 12, 2006, Laura and I stopped in Germany on our way to the G8 summit in St. Petersburg, Russia. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and her husband, Professor Joachim Sauer, had invited us to the town of Stralsund, which was in Angela's home district. Laura and I were fascinated by Angela's description of growing up in communist East Germany. She told us her childhood was happy, but her mother constantly warned her not to mention their family discussions in public. The secret police, the Stasi, were everywhere. Laura and I thought of Angela at Camp David when we watched The Lives of Others, a movie depicting life under the Stasi. It was hard to believe that less than 20 years had passed since tens of millions of Europeans lived like that. It was a reminder of how dramatically freedom could change a society. In addition to serving as a staunch advocate for freedom, Angela was trustworthy, engaging, and warm. She quickly became one of my closest friends on the world stage. While we were on our way to Germany, Hezbollah terrorists in southern Lebanon launched a raid across the Israeli border, kidnapped two Israeli soldiers, and touched off another foreign policy crisis. Israel responded by attacking Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon and bombing the Beirut airport, a transit point for weapons. Hezbollah retaliated by lobbing rockets at Israeli towns, killing or wounding hundreds of civilians. Like Hamas, Hezbollah had a legitimate political party and a terrorist wing armed and funded by Iran and supported by Syria. Hezbollah was behind the bombing of the American Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983, the murder of a U.S. Navy diver aboard a hijacked TWA flight in 1985, the attacks on the Israeli embassy and a Jewish community center in Argentina in 1992 and 1994, and the bombing of the Khobar Towers housing complex in Saudi Arabia in 1996. Now, Hezbollah was taking on Israel directly. All the G8 leaders at the summit had the same initial reaction. Hezbollah had instigated the conflict, and Israel had a right to defend itself. We issued a joint statement that read, "These extremist elements and those that support them cannot be allowed to plunge the Middle East into chaos and provoke a wider conflict." The Israelis had a chance to deliver a major blow against Hezbollah and their sponsors in Iran and Syria. Unfortunately, they mishandled their opportunity. The Israeli bombing campaign struck targets of questionable military value, including sites in northern Lebanon, far from Hezbollah's base. The damage was broadcast on television for all to see. To compound matters, Prime Minister Olmert announced that Syria would not be a target. I thought it was a mistake. Removing the threat of retaliation let Syria off the hook and emboldened them to continue their support of Hezbollah. As the violence continued into its second week, many of the G8 leaders who started out supportive of Israel called for a ceasefire. I didn't join. A ceasefire might provide short-term relief, but it wouldn't resolve the root cause of the conflict. If a well-armed Hezbollah continued to threaten Israel from southern Lebanon, it would be only a matter of time before the fighting flared again. I wanted to buy time for Israel to weaken Hezbollah's forces. I also wanted to send a message to Iran and Syria. They would not be allowed to use terrorist organizations as proxy armies to attack democracies with impunity. Unfortunately, Israel made matters worse. In the third week of the conflict, Israeli bombers destroyed an apartment complex in the Lebanese city of Qana. 28 civilians were killed, more than half of them children. Prime Minister Sinyora was furious. Arab leaders viciously condemned the bombing, the carnage of which played around the clock on Middle Eastern TV. I started to worry that Israel's offensive might topple Prime Minister Sinyora's democratic government. I called a National Security Council meeting to discuss our strategy. The disagreement within the team was heated. "We need to let the Israelis finish off Hezbollah," Dick Cheney said. "If you do that," Condi replied, "America will be dead in the Middle East." She recommended we seek a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire and deploying a multinational peacekeeping force. Neither choice was ideal. In the short run, I wanted to see Hezbollah and their backers badly damaged. In the long run, our strategy was to isolate Iran and Syria as a way to reduce their influence and encourage change from within. If America continued to back the Israeli offensive, we would have to veto one UN resolution after the next. Ultimately, instead of isolating Iran and Syria, we would isolate ourselves. I decided that the long-run benefits of keeping the pressure on Syria and Iran outweighed the short-run gains of striking further blows against Hezbollah. I sent Condi to the UN, where she negotiated Resolution 1701, which called for an immediate end to the violence, the disarmament of Hezbollah and other militias in Lebanon, an embargo on weapon shipments, and the deployment of a robust international security force to southern Lebanon. The Lebanese government, Hezbollah, and Israel all accepted the resolution. The ceasefire took effect on the morning of August 14th. Israel's war against Hezbollah in Lebanon was another defining moment in the ideological struggle. While it remains fragile and still faces pressure from Syria, Lebanon's young democracy emerged stronger for having endured the test. The result for Israel was mixed. Its military campaign weakened Hezbollah and helped secure its border. At the same time, the Israelis' shaky military performance cost them international credibility. As the instigators of the conflict, Hezbollah, along with Syria and Iran, bore responsibility for the bloodshed. The Lebanese people knew it. In the most telling analysis of the war, Hezbollah chief Hassan Nasrallah apologized to the Lebanese people 2 weeks after the ceasefire. "Had we known that the capture of the soldiers would have led to this," he said, we would definitely not have done it. When Condi took her first trip to Europe as Secretary of State in early 2005, she told me she expected our disagreements over Iraq to be the main issue. A week later, she reported back with a surprising message from the allies she'd met. "They're not talking about Iraq," she said. "They're all worried about Iran." By the time I took office, the theocratic regime in Iran had presented a challenge to American presidents for more than 20 years. Governed by radical clerics who seized power in the 1979 revolution, Iran was one of the world's leading state sponsors of terror. At the same time, Iran was a relatively modern society with a budding freedom movement. In August 2002, an Iranian opposition group came forward with evidence that the regime was building a covert uranium enrichment facility in Natanz, along with a secret heavy water production plant in Arak, two telltale signs of a nuclear weapons program. The Iranians acknowledged the enrichment, but claimed it was for electricity production only. If that was true, why was the regime hiding it? And why did Iran need to enrich uranium when it didn't have an operable nuclear power plant? All of a sudden, there weren't so many complaints about including Iran in the axis of evil. On October 2003, 7 months after we removed Saddam Hussein from power, Iran pledged to suspend all uranium enrichment and reprocessing. In return, the United Kingdom, Germany, and France agreed to provide financial and diplomatic benefits, such as technology and trade cooperation. The Europeans had done their part, and we had done ours. The agreement was a positive step toward our ultimate goal of stopping Iranian enrichment and preventing a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. In June 2005, everything changed. Iran held a presidential election. The process was suspicious, to say the least. The Council of Guardians, a handful of senior Islamic clerics, decided who was on the ballot. The clerics used the Bazij Corps, a militia-like unit of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, to manage turnout and influence the vote. Tehran Mayor Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner. Not surprisingly, he had strong support from the Bazij. Ahmadinejad steered Iran in an aggressive new direction. The regime became more repressive at home, more belligerent in Iraq, and more proactive in destabilizing Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, and Afghanistan. Ahmadinejad called Israel a stinking corpse that should be wiped off the map. He dismissed the Holocaust as a myth. He used the United Nations speech to predict that the hidden Imam would reappear to save the world. I started to worry we were dealing with more than just a dangerous leader. This guy could be nuts. As one of his first acts, Ahmadinejad announced that Iran would resume uranium conversion. He claimed it was part of Iran's civilian nuclear power program, but the world recognized the move as a step toward enrichment for a weapon. Vladimir Putin, with my support, offered to provide fuel enriched in Russia for Iran's civilian reactors, once it built some, so that Iran would not need its own enrichment facilities. Ahmadinejad rejected the proposal. The Europeans also offered to support an Iranian civilian nuclear program in exchange for halting its suspect nuclear activities. Ahmadinejad rejected that, too. There was only one logical explanation. Iran was enriching uranium to use in a bomb. I faced a major decision point. America would not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. The theocratic regime would be able to dominate the Middle East, blackmail the world, pass nuclear weapons technology to its terrorist proxies, or use the bomb against Israel. I thought about the problem in terms of two ticking clocks. One measured Iran's progress toward the bomb. The other tracked the ability of the reformists to instigate change. My objective was to slow the first clock and speed the second. I had three options to consider. Some in Washington suggested that America should negotiate directly with Iran. I believe talking to Ahmadinejad would legitimize him and his views and dispirit Iran's freedom movement, slowing the change clock. I also doubted that America could make much progress in one-on-one talks with the regime. Bilateral negotiations with a tyrant rarely turn out well for a democracy, because they are subjected to little accountability. Totalitarian regimes face no pressure to honor their word. They are free to break agreements and then make new demands. A democracy has a choice: give in or provoke a confrontation. The second option was multilateral diplomacy, conducted with both carrots and sticks. We could join the Europeans in offering Iran a package of incentives in return for abandoning its suspect nuclear activities. If the regime refused to cooperate, the coalition would then impose tough sanctions on Iran, individually and through the UN. The sanctions would make it harder for Iran to obtain technology needed for a weapon, slowing the bomb clock. They would also make it harder for Ahmadinejad to fulfill his economic promises, which would strengthen the country's reform movement. The final option was a military strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. This goal would be to stop the bomb clock, at least temporarily. It was uncertain what the impact on the reform clock would be. Some thought destroying the regime's prized project would embolden the opposition. Others worried that a foreign military operation would stir up Iranian nationalism and unite the people against us. I directed the Pentagon to study what would be necessary for a strike. Military action would always be on the table, but it would be my last resort. I discussed the options with the National Security Team extensively in the spring of 2006. I consulted closely with Vladimir Putin, Angela Merkel, and Tony Blair. They assured me they would support strong sanctions if Iran did not change its behavior. In May, Condi announced that we would join the Europeans in negotiating with Iran, but only if the regime verifiably suspended its enrichment. She then worked with the UN Security Council to set a deadline for Iran's response, August 31st. The summer passed, and the answer never came. The next challenge was to develop effective sanctions. There wasn't much America could do on our own. We had sanctioned Iran heavily for decades. I directed the Treasury Department to work with its European counterparts to make it harder for Iranian banks and businesses to move money. We also designated the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, which allowed us to freeze their assets. Our partners in the diplomatic coalition imposed new sanctions of their own, and we worked with the UN Security Council to pass resolutions 1737 and 1747, which banned Iranian arms exports, froze key Iranian assets, and prohibited any country from providing Iran with nuclear weapons-related equipment. Persuading the Europeans, Russians, and Chinese to agree on the sanctions was a diplomatic achievement. But every member faced the temptation to split off and take commercial advantage. I frequently reminded our partners about the dangers of a nuclear-armed Iran. On October 2007, a reporter asked me about Iran at a press conference. "I've told people that if you're interested in avoiding World War III," I said, "it seems like you ought to be interested in preventing them from having the knowledge necessary to make a nuclear weapon." My reference to World War III produced near hysteria. Protesters showed up outside my speeches with signs that read, "Keep us out of Iran." Journalists authored breathless, gossip-laden stories portraying America on the brink of war. They all missed the point. I wasn't looking to start a war. I was trying to hold our coalition together to avoid one. In November 2007, the intelligence community produced a national intelligence estimate on Iran's nuclear program. It confirmed that, as we suspected, Iran had operated a secret nuclear weapons program in defiance of its treaty obligations. It also reported that in 2003, Iran had suspended its covert effort to design a warhead, considered by some to be the least challenging part of building a weapon. Despite the fact that Iran was testing missiles that could be used as a delivery system and had announced its resumption of uranium enrichment, The NIE opened with an eye-popping declaration. We judge with high confidence that in fall 2003, Tehran halted its nuclear weapons program. The NIE's conclusion was so stunning that I felt certain it would immediately leak to the press. As much as I disliked the idea, I decided to declassify the key findings so that we could shape the news stories with the facts. The backlash was immediate. Ahmadinejad hailed the NIE as a great victory. Momentum for new sanctions faded among the Europeans, Russians, and Chinese. As New York Times journalist David Sanger rightly put it, the new intelligence estimate relieved the international pressure on Iran, the same pressure that the document itself claimed had successfully forced the country to suspend its weapons ambitions. In January 2008, I took a trip to the Middle East, where I tried to reassure leaders that we remained committed to dealing with Iran. Israel and our Arab allies found themselves in a rare moment of unity. Both were deeply concerned about Iran and furious with the United States over the NIE. In Saudi Arabia, I met with King Abdullah and members of the Sudairi Seven, the influential full brothers of the late King Fahd. Your Majesty, may I begin the meeting? I asked. I'm confident every one of you believes I wrote the NIE as a way to avoid taking action against Iran. No one said a word. The Saudis were too polite to confirm their suspicion aloud. You have to understand our system, I said. The NIE was produced independently by our intelligence community. I am as angry about it as you are. The NIE didn't just undermine diplomacy. It also tied my hands on the military side. There were many reasons I was concerned about undertaking a military strike on Iran, including its uncertain effectiveness and the serious problems it would create for Iraq's fragile young democracy. But after the NIE, how could I possibly explain using the military to destroy the nuclear facilities of a country the intelligence community said had no active nuclear weapons program? I don't know why the NIE was written the way it was. I wondered if the intelligence community was trying so hard to avoid repeating its mistake on Iraq that it had underestimated the threat from Iran. I certainly hoped intelligence analysts weren't trying to influence policy. Whatever the explanation, the NIE had a big impact, and not a good one. I spent much of 2008 working to rebuild the diplomatic coalition against Iran. In March, we were able to get another round of UN sanctions, which banned countries from trading with Iran in dual-use technologies that could be employed in a nuclear weapons program. We also expanded our missile defense shield, including a new system based in Poland and the Czech Republic, to protect Europe from an Iranian launch. At the same time, I worked to speed the reform clock by meeting with Iranian dissidents, calling for the release of political prisoners, funding Iranian civil society activists, and using radio and internet technology to broadcast pro-freedom messages into Iran. We also explored a wide variety of intelligence programs and financial measures that could slow the pace or increase the cost of Iran's nuclear weapons program. I regret that I ended my presidency with the Iranian issue unresolved. I did hand my successor an Iranian regime more isolated from the world and more heavily sanctioned than it had ever been. I was confident that the success of the surge and the emergence of a free Iraq on Iran's border would inspire Iranian dissidents and help catalyze change. I was pleased to see the Iranian freedom movement express itself in nationwide demonstrations after Ahmadinejad's fraudulent re-election in June 2009. In the faces of those brave protesters, I believe we saw the future of Iran. If America and the world stand with them while keeping the pressure on the Iranian regime, I am hopeful the government and its policies will change. But one thing is for certain. The United States should never allow Iran to threaten the world with a nuclear bomb. Iran was not the only nation endangering the freedom agenda by seeking nuclear weapons. In the spring of 2007, I received a highly classified report from a foreign intelligence partner. We pored over photographs of a suspicious, well-hidden building in the eastern desert of Syria. The structure bore a striking resemblance to the nuclear facility at Yongbyon, North Korea. We concluded that the structure contained a gas-cooled, graphite-moderated reactor capable of producing weapons-grade plutonium. Since North Korea was the only country that had built a reactor of that model in the past 35 years, our strong suspicion was that we had just caught Syria red-handed trying to develop a nuclear weapons capability with North Korean help. That was certainly the conclusion of Prime Minister Olmert. "George, I'm asking you to bomb the compound," he said in a phone call shortly after I received the report. "Thank you for raising this matter," I told the Prime Minister. "Give me some time to look at the intelligence, and I'll give you an answer." I convened the National Security Team for a series of intense discussions. As a military matter, the bombing mission would be straightforward. The Air Force could destroy the target, no sweat. But bombing a sovereign country with no warning or announced justification would create severe blowback. A second option would be a covert raid. We studied the idea seriously. But the CIA and the military concluded that it would be too risky to slip a team into and out of Syria with enough explosives to blow up the facility. The third option was to brief our allies on the intelligence, jointly expose the facility, and demand that Syria shutter and dismantle it under the supervision of the IAEA. With the regime's duplicity exposed, we could use our leverage to press Syria to end its support for terror and meddling in Lebanon and Iraq. If Syria refused to dismantle the facility, we would have a clear public rationale for military action. Before I made a decision, I asked CIA Director Mike Hayden to conduct an intelligence assessment. He explained that the analysts had high confidence that the plant housed a nuclear reactor. But because they could not confirm the location of the facilities necessary to turn the plutonium into a weapon, they had only low confidence of a Syrian nuclear weapons program. Mike's report clarified my decision. "I cannot justify an attack on a sovereign nation unless my intelligence agencies stand up and say it's a weapons program," I said to Olmert. I told him I had decided on the diplomatic option, backed by the threat of force. "I believe the strategy protects your interests and your state and makes it more likely we can achieve our interests as well." The Prime Minister was disappointed. "This is something that hits at the very serious nerves of this country," he said. He told me the threat of a nuclear weapons program in Syria was an existential issue for Israel, and he worried diplomacy would bog down and fail. "I must be honest and sincere with you. Your strategy is very disturbing to me." That was the end of the call. On September 6, 2007, the facility was destroyed. The experience was revealing on multiple fronts. It confirmed Syria's intention to develop nuclear weapons. It also provided another reminder that intelligence is not an exact science. While I was told that our analysts had only low confidence that the facility was part of a nuclear weapons program, surveillance after the bombing showed Syrian officials meticulously covering up the remains of the building. If the facility was really just an innocent research lab, Syrian President Assad would have been screaming at the Israelis on the floor of the United Nations. That was one judgment I could make with high confidence. Prime Minister Olmert's execution of the strike made up for the confidence I had lost in the Israelis during the Lebanon War. I suggested to Ehud that we let some time go by and then reveal the operation as a way to isolate the Syrian regime. Olmert told me he wanted total secrecy. He wanted to avoid anything that might back Syria into a corner and force Assad to retaliate. This was his operation, and I felt an obligation to respect his wishes. I kept quiet, even though I thought we were missing an opportunity. Finally, the bombing demonstrated Israel's willingness to act alone. Prime Minister Olmert hadn't asked for a green light, and I hadn't given one. He had done what he believed was necessary to protect Israel. One of the most influential books I read during my presidency was Aquarians of Pyongyang by the North Korean dissident Kang Chol-won. The memoir, recommended by my friend Henry Kissinger, tells the story of Kang's 10-year detention and abuse in a North Korean gulag. I invited Kang to the Oval Office, where he recounted the wrenching suffering in his homeland, including terrible famines and persecution. Kang's story stirred up my deep disgust for the tyrant who had destroyed so many lives, Kim Jong-il. Early in the administration, Don Rumsfeld showed me satellite photos of the Korean Peninsula at night. The South was alive with lights, while the North was pure black. I read intelligence reports that malnutrition had left the average North Korean 3 inches shorter than the average South Korean. When I took office in 2001, an estimated 1 million North Koreans had died of starvation in the preceding 6 years. Meanwhile, Kim Jong-il cultivated his appetite for fine cognac, luxury Mercedes, and foreign films. He built a cult of personality that required North Koreans to worship him as a godlike leader. His propaganda machine claimed that he could control the weather, had written 6 renowned operas, and had scored 5 holes in one during his first round of golf. Kim also maintained a nuclear weapons program and a ballistic missile capability that threatened 2 U.S. allies, South Korea and Japan, and could potentially reach America's west coast. Proliferation was a serious concern, as the Syrian reactor incident suggested. In a country desperate for hard currency, nuclear materials and weapon systems made for attractive exports. Our approach to North Korea was the topic of one of my first National Security Council meetings, the day before a visit by President Kim Dae-jung of South Korea. The previous administration had negotiated the agreed framework, which gave Kim Jong-il economic benefits in exchange for freezing his nuclear weapons program. Evidently, he wasn't satisfied. In 1998, the regime fired a Taepodong missile over Japan. In 1999, its ships fired on South Korean vessels in the Yellow Sea. A month after I took office, the regime threatened to restart long-range missile tests if we did not continue negotiations on normalizing relations. I told my national security team that dealing with Kim Jong-il reminded me of raising children. When Barbara and Jenna were little and wanted attention, they would throw their food on the floor. Laura and I would rush over and pick it up. The next time they wanted attention, they'd throw the food again. "The United States is through picking up his food," I said. The next year, intelligence reports indicated that North Korea was likely operating a secret, highly enriched uranium program, a second path to a nuclear bomb. It was a startling revelation. Kim had cheated on the agreed framework. I made a decision. The United States was done negotiating with North Korea on a bilateral basis. Instead, we would rally China, South Korea, Russia, and Japan to present a united front against the regime. The key to multilateral diplomacy with North Korea was China, which had close ties to its fellow communist nation. The challenge was that China and the United States had different interests on the Korean Peninsula. The Chinese wanted stability. We wanted freedom. They were worried about refugees flowing across the border. We were worried about starvation and human rights. But there was one area where we agreed. It was not in either of our interests to let Kim Jong-il have a nuclear weapon. In October 2002, I invited President Jiang Zemin of China to the ranch in Crawford. I brought up North Korea. "This is a threat not only to the United States, but also to China," I said. I urged him to join us in confronting Kim diplomatically. "The United States and China have different kinds of influence over North Korea. Ours is mostly negative, while yours is positive. If we combined together, we would make an impressive team." President Jiang was respectful, but he told me North Korea was my problem, not his. "Exercising influence over North Korea is very complicated," he said. After a few months with no progress, I tried a different argument. In January 2003, I told President Jiang that if North Korea's nuclear weapons program continued, I would not be able to stop Japan, China's historic rival in Asia, from developing its own nuclear weapons. You and I are in a position to work together to make certain that a nuclear arms race does not begin, I said. In February, I went one step further. I told President Jiang that if we could not solve the problem diplomatically, I would have to consider a military strike against North Korea. The first meeting of the six-party talks took place 6 months later in Beijing. For the first time, North Korean officials sat down at the table and saw representatives of China, Japan, Russia, South Korea, and the United States looking back at them. Progress was gradual. I spent hours on the phone with our partners, reminding them of the stakes and the need to maintain a united front. In September 2005, our patience was rewarded. The North Koreans agreed to abandon all nuclear weapons and return to their commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. I was skeptical. Kim Jong-il had violated his commitments in the past. If he did so again, he would be breaking his word not just to the United States, but to all his neighbors, including China. On the 4th of July, 2006, Kim Jong-il threw his food on the floor. He fired a barrage of missiles into the Sea of Japan. The test was a military failure, but the provocation was real. My theory was that Kim saw the world focused on Iran and was craving attention. He also wanted to test the coalition to see how much he could get away with. I called President Hu Jintao of China, told him Kim Jong-il had insulted China, and urged him to condemn the launch publicly. He released a statement reiterating his commitment to peace and stability and opposing any actions that might intensify the situation. His words were mild, but they were a step in the right direction. 3 months later, North Korea defied the world again by carrying out its first full-fledged nuclear test. President Hu's reaction was firmer this time. "The Chinese government strongly opposes this," he said. "We engaged in conversations to appeal to the North Koreans for restraint. However, our neighbor turned a deaf ear to our advice." With support from all partners in the six-party talks, the UN Security Council unanimously adopted Resolution 1718. The resolution imposed the toughest sanctions on North Korea since the end of the Korean War. The United States also tightened our sanctions on the North Korean banking system and sought to deny Kim Jong-il his precious luxury goods. The pressure worked. In February 2007, North Korea agreed to shut down its main nuclear reactor and allow UN inspectors back into the country to verify its actions. In exchange, we and our six-party partners provided energy aid, and the United States agreed to remove North Korea from our list of state sponsors of terror. In June 2008, North Korea blew up the cooling tower at Yongbyon on international television. In this case, no further verification was necessary. The problem was not solved, however. The people of North